Yahtzee with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind every book, because boy, oh boy, do I have books for you. Coming up over the next few months, I've been getting like 2 dozen books a week lately. So I have a lot of books because I just celebrated the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And today, this is going to be lots of fun because ever since I read Robin Cook's Coma many years ago, I have been a sucker for a medical thriller. And I have a medical thriller for you today. Judy Foreman is an award-winning author. She's a columnist. She's written so many articles about medical subjects. And now she's turned her hand to writing a novel, and it is a fine read. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm so happy to have you on the program today because I've been thinking, as I said, I celebrated the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper last week, which was really exciting. And one of the biggest thrills that I had was that I was able to talk to Robin Cook, because he really started the whole phenomenon of medical thrillers. And I'm sure that, you can appreciate how much he gave to the whole genre, and now you've joined in by writing a really fine novel.
Well, thank you for mentioning him. I'm a huge fan of his, and I took a flyer when I was, authors have to sort of seek out experts to write nice things on the back of the book. They're called blurbs. And I took a flyer, and I called Robin Cook's publisher, and I was out for a walk with a friend, and I got a phone call. And it was Robin Cook, and I just signaled to my friend, get me a pen, get me a paper. And it was Robin Cook himself. He did wind up giving a beautiful blurb for my book, and I had a number of really nice conversations with him. He is not only a fantastic medical thriller writer, he's really a gentleman and a very, very, very nice person. So I feel really lucky that you mentioned Robin Cook and me in the same breath on the same show. I'm a huge admirer of his.
Well, the minute I got the book, and then, I get these books really early on, so I don't have the blurbs that go with them. And so as I'm reading it, I immediately started thinking of Robin, because it was really one of the joys of my life was to have him on my program, because I had admired his books for so many years, and then to have him and to be able to talk to him. I had just started the program. I'd been doing it for about a year, so it was like so thrilling. And then to see that you got this wonderful blurb from him, I was really impressed.
Well, thank you. I was really thrilled.
Well, he's a wonderful, wonderful person, and I hope he'll come back on soon, because I could talk to him for an hour easily about all of his books.
Oh, I know he's working on something else.
I know. That's the wonderful thing about being a writer. You can keep going and going and going.
That's true.
Well, let's talk about this. Is the title is Crisped. It's CRISPR apostrophe D. So you're pronouncing it CRISPRed?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
So CRISPRed. And of course, it is a medical thriller. And let's talk about, first of all, after so many years of writing nonfiction, what prompted you that finally you're going to write your novel?
I have no idea. It just seemed like fun, and I just thought I would give it a try. And I've been fascinated by CRISPR. We can talk about CRISPR per se if you want, but it's basically a gene editing technique. And I just started wondering what would happen if this really powerful technique ended up in the wrong hands, which is a possibility. And I don't know, my imagination just took off from there. I want to make sure I tell your listeners, though, that the science of CRISPR, which is, as you said, is CRISPR, in my book, is 100% accurate. I interviewed very famous Harvard geneticist, George Church, to make sure I got the science right. So I know I'm confident in the science, and then the rest is a takeoff from my imagination. Can I just mention that I'm hearing an echo? Are you?
I'm not. We're not hearing an echo. I just looked at my guy behind the window, and he's shaking his head. It sounds good from our end.
As long as, okay, your end that counts.
Yeah. Okay.
So would you like me to explain a little bit about what CRISPR does?
Yes, because I think it's a new term for many people. Although I've always been interested in science, and I was actually a candy striper when I read Coma. I was working in a hospital as a candy striper. So I've always taken an interest in medical ideas and medical subjects, but I missed this. I wasn't really familiar with it.
Yeah, no, it's new for a lot of people, although it's in my mind, probably the most important development in biology, possibly all of science, in the last few decades. CRISPR is an acronym. It stands for, and nobody has to remember this, Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. In plain English, that just means it's a string of so-called letters or little chunks on the DNA molecule. And it works. Like, if you can imagine the little pull thing on a zipper on your jacket, CRISPR is a molecule like a little pull thing. And scientists can program it to chug along the DNA just like along those teeth of the zipper and land at a particular place that they've designed it to land on. And then it carries with it a little pair of molecular scissors, if you will, and it cuts the DNA right where it lands. And then it can either take out a gene or put in a new gene or modify a bad gene that's causing disease. It's essentially cut and paste with molecular biology. It's really a cut and paste program. And it's brilliant. In fact, the two women who won the Nobel Prize, I think it was last year, got the Nobel Prize for this. It's a huge, huge deal with the potential to actually cure some genetic diseases. And I don't use the word cure lightly. Scientists don't use the word cure lightly, but it really does have the potential to fix some of the things that go wrong in our genes. It also has the potential for evil, which is where my crafty little imagination took us with this book.
It certainly took us on a journey. Wow. It's frightening in so many ways, this whole concept that, yes, I think after what we've gone through this past 2 years, this pandemic-y time, and we see what happens when scientists play with things, it's a little frightening, I think. And what I like about the book is that it really does explain the science so well. And it is something that people should be aware of. So you're getting because it's something that's going to be going on and could affect all of us. So I, as a science writer, you've done a terrific job of explaining the scientific part without making it, too difficult to understand. Other than we're not going to remember what the letters stand for. But other than that,
neither do I. To be honest, I have to keep looking at my notes. What does this stand for? But the word CRISPR or the acronym CRISPR that people can remember. As an example of some of the good that this can do, scientists are working really hard on a disease called sickle cell anemia, which affects mainly African Americans. And it's basically a problem with your red blood cells. They get all twisted into weird shapes, so they can't slide around the corner of blood vessels the way normally shaped red blood cells do. And it's excruciatingly painful. And it's caused by a gene mishap, a bad gene. And scientists have been able to use CRISPR, scientists from Harvard and MIT at the Broad Institute, which is part of both Harvard and MIT, scientists have been able to cure this disease in mice using CRISPR. There's also an 18-year-old girl in Texas who has had sickle cell disease, And she has been, they're not quite calling it a cure, but she seems to be disease-free with gene editing to cure her sickle cell. So there's tremendous potential, as well as potential for harm. So it's like any big new scientific development, it holds the promise of both good things and bad things.
So you came out with an idea. You got the scientist. So tell us about the scientist. And then, of course, the wonderful thing, and I love this too, that you have a journalist who is on a quest here to find out the truth about what is happening with this research. So tell us the basic outline of the story. You know, without giving too much away, we don't want to tell, you know, what's going to happen, but go ahead.
Okay. It's always hard to talk about it without, you know, spoiling the ending. But yes, there's the heroine of the story is really the journalist, who I must say is based on myself, although she's probably a better journalist than I could ever be. She works at a paper, I call it the Boston Times. I myself was at the Boston Globe. And she's an investigative reporter. And happily, she is married happily to a molecular biologist at MIT. Meanwhile, there's this made-up, invented fertility clinic outside of Boston, and totally my imagination, and they do IVF, in vitro fertilization, to help infertile couples get pregnant. And the product of in vitro fertilization is obviously embryos, which are then implanted into the mothers to carry to term and deliver as babies. So I invented this character, and even though my friends think I've modeled it on some scientist I know, I did not. I made this guy up. I made up his actions, and I made up his whole backstory. And he, suffice it to say, he tampers with some, but not all, of the embryos that he has created in his lab. He takes out a perfectly healthy gene and puts in a lethal gene that kills babies after they're born at about the year, 1 year of age. And it's, I don't...
No, let's not go on from there. One of the things I love, I mean, the whole point of reading a thriller is that you don't know everything up front, and you have to turn the pages,
right.
And you have to find out what...
Shut up.
You know, and it's hard, you know, when you're talking about a thriller, you don't want to give too much away. And as I said, that's part of the fun, that you turn the pages because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know, you're going in, you know, it's like with coma, you know somebody's going to die.
Something's
going to happen. And that is really the joy of writing, when you create that feeling with the reader that, I want to know what's going to happen. I want to know what's going to happen. And to start worrying about the characters. And so, of course, as you said, Sammy is sort of based on you. And so she's someone who's interested in science, interested in following a lead, and seeing where it takes you.
That's right. That's right. And thank you for stopping me from giving too much away, because, I mean, I obviously know this story too well, and I love talking about it. So thank you for avoiding a too big a spoiler alert.
Exactly.
It was really fun to write this. It was a lot of work, but it was really fun, too.
Well, you know, it's always the way when you start a character, and, well, you know, you're, of course, a writer, and Sammy's a writer, and there's so much that, you know, is, I'm sure, that you've taken from yourself and from others, but a character just sometimes just takes on a life of their own and goes their own way.
Yeah. No, and there were some exciting points during the writing process where I really didn't know what was going to happen, and then something in the character of the character or of a character made it go a certain direction. I thought, that's really cool. You're completely right. You know, one of the interesting things of going from scientific writing and journalistic writing, nonfiction, was going into fiction, because for newspaper reporting, which I've done my whole life, first of all, you tell the truth, And second of all, you put it right out front in the first paragraph. You try not to confuse readers. You try not to leave them dangling. You try to tell them the big, most important facts right up front, and then sort of subsidiary details lower down in the story. With thriller writing, you know, you can't do that. You have to kind of string them along and put in little red herrings and to throw them off track and put in sort of false clues. And that was something, obviously, I had never done before in my life. I was shocked when one of my editors said, no, you got to throw in some red herrings. You know, you can't make it too obvious. I said, oh, God, I'm so used to making things crystal clear. Now I have to muddy things up. It was quite an experience. I have a lot of respect for novelists now. No, I mean, not that I didn't before, but now I have even more.
Well, it is a fine art, especially with thrillers, because you're right. You have to have those red herrings. You have to have little things in there that people don't notice, but then it all makes sense, you know, when you get to the end. And
right,
that's a little tricky, but you've done a great job. And I really enjoy Sammy. I like her very much, and I can't help but wonder if we're going to see Sammy again.
I'm hoping you will. I'm working on another one, and Sammy's going to be there.
That's, you know, it's so funny. I'm always good at this. I get somebody will send me a standalone, and, you know, I read it, and somewhere, if I really like it, somewhere around page 25, page 30, I start thinking to myself, aha, this is going to be a series. Even if the author doesn't know it while she's writing it, it's going to turn into a series, because the character takes over. And you want to know more about the character. So I'm sure there's so many depths to Sammy that are going to come out over the years as you continue this with what I call now a series, a real Judy Foreman series.
Right. That'd be exciting. Yes. No, I deliberately have decided for my next novel to keep Sammy as the heroine. The different bad guy and another heroine too. Kind of, there's going to be two heroines in the next book, but I'm just beginning. I'm really at the very early stages. Although I do have two big white plastic containers full of notes. I've already interviewed quite a few people for that one. So anyway, wish me luck.
No, I do. I do. I'll keep my fingers crossed. It's funny, you know, when years ago when I read Coma, as I said, I actually remember where I read it. I was reading it in the break room of the little hospital where I worked. We had a 35-bed hospital, and I was a candy striper. And in my breaks, I would sit there and read it because, you know, it was medical, and I was interested in medicine. I went on. Eventually, I became a lab technician for a while, so I know all about sickle cell, and I cannot tell you how many slides I looked at under the microscope, and I did find sickle cell. So it's that was my job. So, you know, I remember reading that book, and I remember in those days, of course, we didn't have streaming video, and we didn't have anything like that. So, and I didn't even in those days think about, well, there's going to be a movie one day. But, I just loved the book. But nowadays, when I'm reading a book, I also get that vibe, like, keep it up, girl, because eventually you're going to have a series here.
Yeah, and I would love if CRISPR turned into a movie. I think it's sort of written in a way that could pretty easily be adapted to, scenes in a movie. But who knows?
Well, what do you need nowadays? It's more the best ones are really to be streaming. So, like, you need a series of books. They're not doing these feature films like they used to. You know, it's not a feature film nowadays. It's so expensive to do. But when they have a series they can put on streaming video, that's the kind of thing they're looking for. So I have a feeling it's going to take you a few books. But you make Sammy, you know, you give Sammy a really interesting life, an interesting personality, and just grow on it. I see something in the future for you and for Sammy.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you from both of us.
Okay. Well, I just, you know, I always love when I come across a new talent, and I think that you've got it, and it's going to be, it's just going to be fun to watch you develop. And so, yep, I'm got my fingers crossed for you. Now,
great, thank you so much.
Okay.
And if you can send a link, if this becomes a podcast or something I can put on my website so people can hear it if they didn't hear this live, that would be great.
Yeah, oh, it's going to be a podcast. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, too, because as I said, I celebrated the 7th anniversary last week, and I'm just now working on a really dynamic, big web page, and I will have your interview up there this weekend, and you can share it with everybody. Because I want to do more to spread the word about books that I think people should read and just have fun. And I was going to mention, too, I looked it up while I was talking to you here, and Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna won the Nobel Prize for CRISPR. And
right.
So it's something, it's a subject that we should all get to know and understand more. And I think you've done a wonderful job with both the storyline, but also with the science. And we have to know because, you know, it is frightening when you think about it. What if there's no oversight? We need oversight.
Right.
I think one of the things
exactly.
that people will come away from with this book is they'll also understand it. Yeah, you know, let's get some people here overlooking what the scientists are doing. There should be, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad you picked up on that. That's really true.
And, of course, you write about it and you continue writing about scientific subjects. And so it's just, I think it's just wonderful. And it's... It's better, I will tell you, during the pandemic, I was getting really some really gross pandemic-y books. And I was so happy when I got this medical thriller. You know, gene therapy is something that people should know about, and you've done a great job. And do you have a website? I know you have a website. Where do you want people to find you?
JudyForeman.com. JudyForeman.com.
Okay, and probably you're on Facebook and all of that other good stuff.
Yep, all that stuff.
You're learning now as a novelist that you have to do a lot of that kind of stuff, right?
Oh, I know. I don't really like it, but I do it.
Yeah, I heard that. that's what happens. That's what happens.
I know.
Yeah, but you've done a great job, and you hit the ground running when you get a blurb, and a big blurb, not like a two sentence blurb, but a major blurb by Robin Cook. So
that's right.
He's fantastic. And, you know, I hope that he'll be on soon, and maybe by then you'll be back too, okay?
I would like that too. Thank you very much.
Okay, everybody, it's called CRISPRed, and it's a medical thriller by Judy Foreman. Thank you so much for being on the program today, Judy. It was a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye now. Wow. I love medical thrillers. Well, I don't like pandemic-y ones. Don't get sending me any more pandemic-y things. I don't want anything with masks. Don't send me anything with masks. Okay, now we're going to play a book buzz. And this is a great one.
Carol J. Perry's Till Death. The books in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries are so vivid that you feel as if you are right there in Salem, Massachusetts. It might come from the fact that Carol was born there on Halloween Eve. You are invited to a wedding in Till Death, book 12 in this bewitching series. The staff at WICH-TV is looking forward to the wedding of their program director, Lee Barrett, to Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, who have been a hot item for a long time. Lee is busy tying up loose ends before the big day. It'll be an adjustment moving out of her apartment in Aunt Ibby's house, but the couple are moving a few doors down to stay nearby. After all, they have to share custody of Orion, their clairvoyant cat. After the celebration, complete with a cake made by the TV station magician, Lee and Pete are looking forward to getting to their honeymoon destination, Pirate Island in Maine. The newlyweds don't realize that soon they will be opening a mystery that hits very close to home for Lee Barrett, the death of Lee's parents 30 years earlier. There's lots of intrigue and suspense as Lee and Pete's honeymoon ends up being more eventful than they anticipated. And Lee has to put their wedding gifts aside and turns to her psychic gifts instead. If the Mondellos want to enjoy their honeymoon, they will have to wrap up crimes both past and present. Meanwhile, Aunt Ibby, a feisty former librarian who is a computer whiz, is planning to rent out Lee's old apartment. But she's getting some bad vibes from her prospective tenant. As always, Carol J. Perry's writing is rich and multi-layered. She has a talent for introducing intriguing new characters, and in this book, readers get to meet Lee's extended family, even if they are quite odd and possibly murderers. A great read with some psychic witchery vibes, and of course, Orion, the cat with a cool personality. Be a guest at the wedding. Pre-order Carol J. Perry's Till Death. Do it now. It will be released this spring on April 26th, and be ready for a thrilling and poignant adventure in this latest Witch City Mystery series. Another great book from Kensington Publishing.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z, and I am back with my next guest. Oh, and this is going to be a rather difficult interview because I have walked in her shoes in many ways, and I am so honored to welcome to Joy on Paper Anna Selton Eisen, who has written a book called Pillar of Salt, A Daughter's Life in the Shadow of the Holocaust, and she did it with her brother, Aaron Eisen. Anna, hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, as I explained, this is a book that really touched my heart. It's beautifully written, beautifully written. My family also made the trip to Poland. and I'll let you explain what that means and how you came about to write this book. It is so touching. It is so really, I cried in parts of it, but in other parts I was filled with a kind of joy, because you went and you did something that many people have been afraid to do, but I think you got a lot out of it, and I think your story will help people to understand.
Sure. Thank you for your kind words. Well, like a lot of children of Holocaust survivors, I grew up in a home where it just wasn't talked about. I think it was a combination of my parents wanting to protect us from such, horrific, truthful tales. And also, I think there was a great emphasis for them to start a new life, put the past behind them. And there wasn't really much acknowledgement or, awareness of how to deal with trauma. So, I discovered these two watercolor paintings in a drawer when I was about 8 or 9 that were signed by a name I didn't recognize, an L. Zaltzman. And they were really horrific scenes of the ghetto and, a pit filled with bodies. And I just kind of had the intuitive feeling that I had come across something that I shouldn't have found. So, I put them away and really never spoke of them. And in my house, there was not really talk about the Holocaust. We didn't have, any family pictures, and we were not part of a Holocaust survivor community. So I kind of undertook my own secret education, looking for books in school. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s and I moved to Dallas with my new husband where they had a Holocaust museum. So I ventured in one day and just discovered everything. On the walls, there, were photographs and captions, and I became a docent there and really kind of an amateur expert on those years, everything from Hitler's rise to power, 1933, the boycott of Jewish businesses, the burning of books, the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, Kristallnacht in 1938, and, the camps and ghettos. After this, I actually had a short stint where I was doing survivor interviews for the Spielberg Foundation, and it was while doing the interviews that I just came to the realization that I did not want, there to be some stranger interviewing my father at arm's length, that it needed to be me. And so I flew from Texas to Washington and confronted him. And, he responded that he was Adam, that everything before him was gone, everything and everyone, and it started over with him. And I disagreed. I said, all I know about the person I'm named for is that she died in a gas chamber, and it's not enough. So thus began, conversation and this trip to Poland where, as my father and guide, he took, the family to the major sites, Auschwitz, the Warsaw Ghetto, important places, but also to the small town and cities where he was in the ghetto in Rzeszów, and where his family was murdered at the Belzec extermination camp. And so then when I returned, living in the small town in Texas, it just really changed me. And I started to investigate my faith more, and I also just wanted to write it down. I didn't want it to end with me. So I helped him write his memoir, and then that came out in 2002 and is being re-released this fall, called The 23rd Psalm. And then I wrote this follow-up book, which goes back with him, tells about my childhood, and then it's like a travelogue through Poland, and then the afterwards, which is full of amazing coincidences where we meet children of survivors who were with him and children of the heroic American liberators of the 82nd Airborne.
As I was reading the book, of course, I was so moved because we went to Poland, and we went to Lublin. That's where my mother-in-law was born, and they were for their family. They were actually a very well-off family, and they lived outside. Lublin had a ghetto, a walled ghetto for Jews. You know, that went back centuries. But they lived outside, and they lived actually, they had a beautiful building next to the police station. And as a family, we went there. We stood in front of the building. My mother-in-law was in Israel. As a matter of fact, she was on the phone when we got there. And we told her, you know, where we were. And she described it exactly. She described the building. She knew every window. She told us which window was hers. And she talked. That's the first time she had ever talked about a collection of dolls that she had. She had a dozen dolls. And she said to look up at this window. And she used to take each of the dolls every day. She'd stand at the window. There was a year where she was sickly, and she was mostly in her room, and she'd take one of the dolls to the window for fresh air. And we stood there, and it was so emotional. So when you went there and you felt the same things, you visited the places where your family actually lived.
Yes, and thank you for sharing that story about your mother-in-law. It's really a beautiful story, and I think it's a testimony to the power that these memories had when they can be shared in new generations. But yes, we went back to where my father had been in the ghetto, in the town of Rzeszów, which now the 82nd Airborne is there once again. That's there in an airfield there helping with what's going on in Ukraine. But we went there, and it was just amazing. We would walk the streets, and the memories would flood in. My father might say, you know, down this street, I had an uncle, and we would walk and then come to a building, and we would go, you know, up the staircase and just stand in front of this door. And at that moment, he wasn't, you know, ready to knock or go in. I mean, I don't know what he might expect. But then when we left Rzeszów, where he had been in the ghetto and gone to his hometown called Tychyn, which was a very small town. You could walk from one end to the other. We actually had the opportunity to go into his childhood home. We were walking on the street, and my mother, you know, both my parents speak many languages, started conversing with an older Polish woman who was, you know, very excited to have American tourists and, you know, walked with us. And then even though my father had said, you know, he didn't want to go in, you know, within a minute we were there and the door opened and we were all ushered inside. So it was really very emotional to go in and see, you know, where my father had lived, where my grandparents who, you know, were killed in the Holocaust had been, you know, to walk in my grandmother's kitchen. And so much was not changed. You know, the old tile on the floor, the handrails on the staircase were worn with age. And then at one point, my brother and I went into the attic, which was just a doorway into a room. It wasn't a ladder. You know, and I had always had this dream that I would find something of my grandparents. You know, some photographs or a prayer shawl. But there was nothing to be found. There was just a room with, you know, building materials and some old metal bookcases with, you know, no books even. But at least I took some comfort that I had gone and tried and, you know, made this pilgrimage. But it was definitely life-changing. And from that time and then writing my memoir and now to this day, you know, the Holocaust has not just shaped my identity, but really affected how I live my life, you know, in pursuing Holocaust education, fighting anti-Semitism and racism and prejudice of all shapes and forms, and then just trying to bring an education of this time, this horrific time in human history, to our society so that people hopefully will fight hate and we can, you know, never revisit such a terrible experience again.
Well, of course, here in St. Petersburg, Clearwater area, we have a Holocaust museum. And I visited a lot of Holocaust museums in Miami, of course, Washington. And it just was always so overwhelming. And nowadays, of course, we're talking, it's incredible that there's another war and that that it's right there. And when I think having the past few weeks listening to them talk so much about Poland, it's brought back so many memories for me, because when we were there, we did, I tell you, the people who live in that home, which was my mother-in-law's home, they were not happy to see us. And my husband and my boys wore their kippahs all the time that we were in Poland. They never took their kippah off. And sometimes we'd have, you know, some strange reactions, although in other cases we had many people who did embrace us and were very kind and took us in and invited us, you know, into their homes. And I can tell you, we had some of the best meals that we ever ate in our lives in Poland.
Yeah, wonderful food, baked goods. I mean, it's just incredible.
And you'd, like we did, we drove all, flew into Berlin and rented a car. And so we drove right across the border and we drove all over Poland. And our first place to stop, you know, I had two young boys in the bakery, find a bakery.
Right. The incredible poppy seed pastries, Makowiec, which is made from fresh poppy seeds that are dried and pressed, not what we get here in United States out of the can. But yes, the food was incredible everywhere we went. And so it was a good balance because, you know, the days were filled with heartbreaking visits to, you know, deserted and empty cemeteries and synagogues and places of great destruction. But every night we could at least sit as a family and have dinner and, you know, feel grateful and blessed that, you know, we were back, you know, as a part of a family pilgrimage, that we were free and together. And, you know, so we needed to end each day with something that would, you know, give us strength to go and do it again the next day.
Well, sometimes, you know, people don't understand, certainly for children whose parents were in the Holocaust, it is so difficult, and you've explained it in the book. But even for Jews who weren't, you know, didn't have family in the Holocaust, I know I went through that phase. I was about 16 when I had an entire year. I read every book about the Holocaust, books that I look back and I don't know even how I managed to read them. Some of them were so horrific, but it's some need to understand. As a matter of fact, at one point, I was so overcome by it. I think I went for like 3 weeks, and all I would eat, and it was drove my mother crazy. All I would eat was watered down soup. I said, if they could do it, I could do it. And I went for weeks like that until my mother finally put a foot down and said, eat. You know, but yeah, it's very difficult, and I think. What you've done with this book, the way you've written it, I really, there's a gentleness to this book that I found.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's part of, I think, what I got from my father, is that he was always very gentle, no matter how much brutality he had experienced. And even after his memoir came out and he would go and speak, he was always, you know, very concerned with the listener, that they shouldn't get too upset, and he was just very careful not to share more than what people could possibly, you know, understand and process, and without being, you know, disturbed. And so, you know, and I also have great tenderness and compassion and love for my parents, and I never wanted to try and, you know, judge them or be critical or look at them in some way that possibly they had, you know, come out of this with some kind of, you know, maladaptive behaviors. I'm also a licensed therapist, and I think that's helped give me some understanding of trauma and how it's processed, and how, you know, we're all affected, and also that trauma is not something that's healed alone on your own. It is through the processing and also integration of the history into yourself and re-engaging with other people that the healing occurs. So we need others to listen to us. We need to be able to share our stories, no matter what the cause of the pain is. And I think with the listening and the acceptance and love from other people is the way that people move forward out of trauma. I will say that, you know, my mother is still alive. She is 100 years old. She lives with me. And she's a Holocaust survivor, sharp as a tack, still plays bridge and reads and exercises. But, you know, recently we had an experience that was difficult. I don't know how many people know about this, but it was my congregation where the rabbi was held hostage in Texas. And so that was something that I watched on live stream, and then, you know, I had the painful experience of having to go and tell my mother that this horrific incident was happening in our congregation and all, you know, in our small town. And I could see the flash of pain across her face, and, you know, that in a way the memories came back. So, you know, I think the lessons of the Holocaust obviously are more important than ever, and hopefully we can, you know, share the stories and get other people to, you know, join us in trying to make this a kinder, more respectful, more tolerant world.
Oh, and tell us about Aaron, because, of course...
Yeah, so Aaron is actually, he's my son.
He's your son, yeah.
He's my son, and he, you know, helped me with this book. He had also, after we went to Poland, I went back a second time with my children and my parents. And it was a wonderful experience again, but it was different for me because I got to see my father and my son and my daughter as they walked, and my father really passed on the stories and the legacy of what he had experienced. So I had written this manuscript and I put it aside. I think at the time my father was ill, and I know how much is involved in bringing a book to publication. And so I put it aside and just decided not to publish it. And then, you know, a little over a year ago, my son was here. We had a big ice storm in Dallas, and he found, you know, one last paper copy, which I didn't even know I had. I had pretty much destroyed all the files. And he read it and said, you know, this is something to share. Wow. So he went through it with me. We did a whole rewrite, and we brought it to publication. And then we're also working now on a documentary film called In My Father's Words that will be released in the fall, that kind of intertwines my father's story and then Pillar of Salt and the whole journey of discovery, with footage of going to Poland, the original footage I have, well, my father's testimony and photographs, his artwork and documents, and well, just hopefully, you know, finding a way for the third generation, even the filmmaker is the grand nephew of a woman who was the founder of the Holocaust Museum in Orlando.
Well, you know, I want to thank you so much. I'm running out of time. Tell people where they can find you. You have a website?
Yes. I have a website, AnnaSultanEisen.com, and then the book is available now for pre-order on all the major Amazon, Barnes & Noble, And then if you go to the website, it's got events both in person and virtual. So I'd love for you to tune in. I did a webinar for the Nazi Archives, the Arleson Archives, and I'll be doing similar webinars online that just kind of recreate the history.
Okay, well, I will have this up this weekend on my website, and I will encourage people to go there to pre-order this book. It's called Pillar of Salt by Anna Salton Eisen. It's a touching book. It's a book that it's, although the subject is difficult, the reading of it gives you a great deal of satisfaction. So I really want to thank you so much, Anna, for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing your beautiful stories as well.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Whoa. This one got me. And I did shed some tears remembering what we went through. As I said, I will have it up on my new web page, which I hope will be up this weekend. It's been really a big task, but I was so busy getting ready for the 7th anniversary. And I want to thank all of you who have sent me all sorts of notes and just cards. It's just been wonderful. And also all your emails. Remember, my email is patsy.radio@gmail.com. And you can email me. And you can also then this weekend, you can go to my website, and I will have more information, and I will have both of these interviews up. I'm working to keep them up, getting them up as fast as I can nowadays, because there's so many books that I really hope that you will start reading. I think one of the things that will really help you is, I know that we're overwhelmed with the news of what's happening in the world, but books really help you both to educate you, to take your mind off of some of the stresses that are going on in your life, but also that maybe will awaken something in you, and you yourself will start writing. And that's what I am always encouraging all of you to do, because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. You can pre-order her book, number 12 in her Witch City Mysteries. She's going to be here April 26th. That's the release of her book, and you can get it now. You can go ahead and order it, pre-order it, and she will be here to talk about it. It's going to be fun. And there's a wedding. It's always fun when there's a wedding in a book. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Baguette in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And thank you, my goodness, 7 years, can you believe it? It's been a time. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. Oh, boy, oh, boy, I would have been a great general. I'm telling you, 500 military books. I've been counting them. I've been doing a whole, going through my collection. Wow. Bye-bye now.